Take a network break. Help yourself to a tariff-free virtual donut as we sprint through this week's IT news. I'm Drew Conry-Murray. Jonna Johnson is away, so this week I'm pleased to welcome guest commentator Ned Belavance. You can hear Ned on the Day 2 DevOps podcast here on the Packet Pushers Network, as well as elsewhere on the internet. This episode is brought to you by Catchpoint. Catchpoint is an internet performance monitoring platform. Gives you visibility to everything in the internet stack that impacts your user experience, so you can anticipate, detect, and fix problems fast. Learn more at the break or see for yourself at catchpoint.com/packetpushers. And stay tuned after the news for a sponsored Tech Bytes podcast with Nokia. We're going to discuss Nokia's event-driven automation software, or EDA. It aims to help you automate your data center. EDA is now available as a service. We'll talk about the differences of the on-prem and SaaS versions, standing up cloud instance, and more. All right, Ned, we're going to dive right in with a red alert. Fortinet's warning of a password change vulnerability in its Fortinet switch GUI, which could let a remote unauthenticated attacker modify admin passwords by a specially crafted request. The vulnerability has a CVSS score of 9.3 out of 10. It affects multiple versions of the FortiSwitch from 6.4 through 7.6. A patch is available. As of recording time, no known exploits have been reported.
Boy, it really seems like putting a web UI on any security product is a huge mistake, doesn't it, Drew?
It really does. It really does.
Yeah. I feel like so many of these vulnerabilities that are discovered have to do with some hastily slapped on HTTP server that's using maybe outdated libraries, and then it never gets patched or updated, and suddenly these products are all vulnerable. So CLI only. That's the
We're
answer,
going back to the CLI.
We're going back.
All right, let's dive into some news. Shopify CEO Toby Lutke wrote an internal memo declaring that all employees must now use AI as part of their job. The memo leaked, quickly became something of a manifesto for tech and business leaders, got a lot of play on LinkedIn and so on. Ned, I think you and I have some thoughts. I just want to give a little background. So among the requirements listed, AI use is now a fundamental expectation of every Shopify employee. AI usage questions are going to be added to performance and peer reviews, and teams have to demonstrate why they can't solve a problem with AI before they can ask for new headcount or resources.
That's wonderful. Whenever I see a manifesto coming from a tech leader, I can already tell I'm not going to like it. That's usually a big, big red flag.
I think we're professionally cranky, so.
Well, there is that. But also, AI is just technology. And essentially, this memo is saying, hey, you should use technology at your job. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, no duh. That's not a revolutionary thing to say. And since AI is very squishy in its definition, it's the equivalent of saying, you should use computers. Like, well, yeah, but like, what program should I use? What kind of software are you delivering? Are you giving me any training to be better at this thing?
Right.
Big
right.
concerns there in yes. terms of like, what does it mean to use AI at my job? What does good mean? A good use of AI, you know? If George over in accounts payable decided to use AI to handle all of accounts receivable, and suddenly we're 90 days behind in everything because the AI agent screwed up, was that a good job, George, for deciding to use AI? Or is that bad, George, for trying to use AI?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the memo actually explicitly says that he wants effective use of AI, but that effective is, you know, doing a lot of heavy lifting. Because as you say, what does effective mean? How do we measure it? Right. So yeah, lots of concerns there. Anything else that occurs to you with this memo?
I think it was probably leaked on purpose. I can't prove that, right? So I'm just, I'm making a guess, but yeah. It's like, yeah. Thought leadership
exactly.
and leak memo.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, this is going to have the consequence of driving a bunch of other CEOs to think that they now need to have a similar opinion on AI. So
yes.
I think we're going to see a raft of hastily composed memos fly out of CEO offices in the next few weeks, having similar goals with also similarly like fuzzy objectives mm-hmm. and language behind it.
Yeah, that immediately leaped out at me that this is sort of going to cause like a stampede toward AI strategies that presumably, you know, this CEO and executives in the organization thought about AI and the strategy fits for them. That's great. But manifestos like this tend to spark kind of a herd response where people are like, oh my God, we must do AI. Why? What's the business case? How are we going to do it? What do we mean by AI? And so on. Those kind of questions just get trampled as folks feel like we're going to fall behind.
Exactly. Experimentation and innovation are good things. They will help propel your company forward. But don't forget that the thing that probably makes your company money today is a 30-year-old application that's running on a 20-year-old mainframe in the data center.
Right, which is very apropos because we do have a story about a new IBM mainframe coming up later. So,
precisely. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the other thing that I thought about this is regarding headcount. I feel like as we've seen AI emerge, people have been like, well, what does this mean about, you know, humans actually having jobs? And tech CEOs are like, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. And this, to me, is sort of the clearest language we've had so far that tech executives and maybe executives in other industries are like, yeah, I don't want to have to hire you irritating people anymore. I want to get as much AI as possible on board. So, you know, I guess it's good that we see now what people are actually thinking about the use of AI to, if not cut humans, you know, stop hiring them.
Indeed. Well, that was a bit of a sour note. Let's turn our attention to something that's a celebration.
Please.
Git has turned 20 years old. Congratulations, Git.
Wow.
Who would have
almost drinking age.
I know, right? Back in April 7th, 2005, Linus Torvalds made the first commit to the Git project by using Git itself. So he'd written enough code over the course of 10 days that he could now use the code he'd written to check in the code he'd written to the project.
Whoa.
It's like an Ouroboros, right?
Right. Yeah, I feel like he opened a little tiny black hole or something. Yeah, wow. Okay, so, and I didn't know Linus created Git.
He did. Wow. He's best known for working on the Linux kernel. That's what people probably know him for. And he'd been working on the Linux kernel for, I want to say, about a decade at that point. And he was very frustrated with the source control solution that they'd been using at the time, which was called BitKeeper. His frustration was twofold. One, it was very slow at applying sequential patches. And when you're working in the kernel, I guess there's a lot of patches. And also, it was a closed source piece of software that they didn't have to pay for because the person who ran BitKeeper was a big fan of the open source project. Uh-huh. But it kind of, you know, it was, he didn't like the fact it wasn't also open source. Mm-hmm. So to deal with some of the shortcomings of BitKeeper and also introduce an open source project that met his needs, he, over the course of a few months, envisioned what Git should be. And then in 2005, he sat down and banged out the code, the initial code, in about 10 days.
God. Man, this guy's good.
Yeah, it's almost like he's pretty good at developing software. Yeah. Maybe not so good at interacting with other humans, but really good at doing software.
So, you know, Git comes up. It's coming up more in the networking industry now as we move toward like repositories and sources of truth and network automation and trying to bring more of a software operations approach to NetOps. But I think maybe you have more familiarity with GitHub than probably most of our listeners.
Yeah, I was probably introduced to Git about 10 years ago because I was busy writing a lot of PowerShell scripts and then eventually developing some stuff for infrastructure as code. Mm-hmm. And I really started to need a place for that code to live in a way that other people could collaborate on it and that I could keep, you know, previous versions if something got screwed up. And one of the other people on the team who had come from a development background was like, hey, you should use GitHub. And I was like, what's a GitHub? And that then sort of launched me into the world of Git and GitHub, since GitHub uses Git. But at this point, almost all the source control providers out there use Git. It's just that GitHub is the most popular of the solutions. And they actually have a video up online where they sat down with Linus and discussed with him sort of the history of Git, where it came from, why he built it, and you know, if he had any regrets, if there's anything he wished had made it in. And it's really compelling and interesting conversation for a technology that undergirds so much of the world of software development and modern technology.
Yeah. So isn't GitHub owned by Microsoft?
It is. It wasn't originally. So right. It was founded outside of Microsoft, but they purchased it. Geez, I don't even want to hazard a guess. It was somewhere in the 2010s, I believe. But I'd have to look up exactly when they bought GitHub. That was pretty contentious at the time, you know, since GitHub's all about open source
right.
and giving back to the community. And Microsoft was not really known for that at the time.
Right. I was wondering if they asked, like, if Linus is a little still chapped by that or if bygones are bygones.
Well, he's chapped by a lot of things, so probably, but I didn't see that in the interview. Okay. But yeah, if you are coming from a network background and you think about some of the fundamental things that underpin the internet, like TCP/IP, HTTP, and like BGP, Git is that for software developers. It is just a fundamental thing that everybody uses, and it sort of shores up all of the software development that happens across the world. It's like kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal. I guess I shouldn't be surprised to learn that Linus had his fingerprints are on it. But wow, another feather in his cap.
Indeed.
So we'll have a link to that if you want to go check out the interview in the show notes, but we'll move on. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, has chosen 15 companies to begin the first stage of DARPA's Quantum Benchmarking Initiative, or QBI. QBI aims to, quote, rigorously verify and validate whether any quantum computing approach can achieve utility-scale operation, meaning its computational value exceeds its cost, by the year 2033, end quote. So there are multiple ways to create the qubits required for quantum computation. That includes things like superconducting qubits, trapped ion qubits, photonic qubits. So the goal of DARPA's QBI is to determine if one or more of these approaches can actually lead to feasible quantum computing capabilities. In the first stage, or stage A of QBI, participants are going to participate in a 6-month sprint and, quote, provide comprehensive technical details of their concepts to show that they hold water and could plausibly lead to a transformative, fault-tolerant quantum computer in under 10 years. Stage A participants include IBM and HPE as the sort of big names you might recognize, plus a whole lot of startups. Any thoughts on this, Ned?
Yeah, I do another podcast called Chaos Lever, and we did a whole episode about some of the different ways of creating qubits. And what I discovered in the research for that is there's about 7 different major ways that you can create qubits, but within those ways, there are sort of subcategories of how it's actually instantiated and how you inspect and control those qubits. So there's a lot of variation out there. Right now, superconducting qubits are the most popular option out of all of them. But there are also, like you said, photonic qubits, trapped ion. And you've got Microsoft with their new Majorana chip today. The chip only has like 8 qubits on it, but they are talking about being able to rapidly scale it up to thousands of qubits. Unfortunately, the two big challenges for all the quantum computing that's out there today to make it actually scalable is the ability to hold a state of coherence between all the qubits.
Right.
Once those qubits decohere, you lose the information that's in there, the computation you're trying to do. And when we're talking about the amount of time for coherence, we're talking in the millisecond range. You set up a transaction, you've got milliseconds for it to execute before coherence drops, depending on the technology. And the other thing is error correction. There's a lot of noise that can be introduced when you're trying to read and manipulate these qubits. And allegedly, some of the newer approaches, I think AWS claims their newer approach, and Google also claims their newer approach, fixes the error correction issue as it scales, which would be amazing, because up until now, as you scaled, you got more errors, not less. And I think it was Google, you have to check my math on that, but I think it was Google's new chip. They're claiming that as it scales, the error correction actually improves. And that would be quite a feat if that's true.
That would be.
Oddly enough, they were not among the list of the startups that were selected.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just possible they didn't bother applying to DARPA because they have gobs and gobs of money and didn't want to go through all the paperwork and hassle. And they don't need that money from DARPA. So that may be the reason why. But I appreciate that DARPA is taking a, you know, sort of many eggs and many baskets approach to this, because it does seem like it's a very, very hard problem to solve. And we haven't identified the way or multiple ways that it's actually going to work out. So it's a good idea.
Yeah. All right. I found a story about Oracle fessing up to a couple hack incidents, some security issues.
Yes.
But not in a public way. So apparently Oracle is privately fessing up to being hacked after publicly denying allegations. A hacker that goes by the name of Rose87168, great name, claimed that they had compromised 2 of Oracle Cloud's login servers and harvested about 6 million customer records, offering them for sale on the dark web. And those customer records, they had some pretty sensitive information, including private security keys, credentials, and LDAP info. Woof.
Yeah, that's a lot.
We don't want to lose that stuff.
No. And Oracle was like, no, this didn't happen. It's a lie that mm-hmm. all our customer data is safe, right?
That was their initial contention. And then some security researchers looked into the information being offered and said, no, this is legit. Not only that, but they theorized that the exploit used for the attack was probably a known vulnerability in Oracle's own access manager software, mm-hmm. and that the servers in question had not been patched against that vulnerability, despite the patch being available. So I can kind of see why Oracle didn't want to publicly fess up to that.
Yeah, this vulnerability, if this is how the attacker got in, it's been around since 2021. And when it came out, it was given a severity rating of 9.8 out of 10. So Oracle should have patched it.
Based on reporting from the Register, Big Red, Oracle is claiming that the login servers only had data that was 8 years old. So these were older servers that were maybe being retired or whatever. But some of the customers impacted said, nope, there was stuff from 2024 on there. There is litigation that is currently pending in Texas. So we're going to get some interesting discovery out of that, I think.
Yeah, I think so for sure. Yeah.
This is not the only hack to hit Oracle. They acquired Cerner back in 2022 and renamed it Oracle Health. And in March this year, they sent a letter alerting customers of a possible hack to legacy servers that hadn't been migrated into Oracle Cloud yet. Mm-hmm. And the data that was exfiltrated included both customer and patient data.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, by now the industry has learned that or should have learned that there is, you know, no benefit to denying a breach if it happened. You can't bluff your way out of it. It's going to come out. No. You look foolish. You destroy trust with customers. And I kind of wonder if a cover-up maybe even exposes you to more legal liability than just the breach itself. Like, it's just never a good idea.
No, I think the FEC actually has some rules around disclosure and the speed of disclosure. Mm-hmm. Those might be contested in some sort of court of law at the moment, but they were trying to bring down the disclosure to you had to do it within days, not months, once you discover an incident.
Right, the SEC, yeah. Uh-huh. If you're a publicly traded company. Yeah, not the FEC, but the SEC.
Which Oracle is. So we'll see if the SEC steps in at all, or if they already have their hands full with a lot of other things that are happening right now.
Right. All right, links in the show notes if you want to read up. We'll take a quick pause to bring you a message from sponsor Catchpoint. Catchpoint is an internet performance monitoring platform. It gives you visibility into everything in the internet stack that impacts your user experience to anticipate, detect, and fix problems fast. Catchpoint helps you proactively identify and resolve issues across the stack before they impact customers, workforce, or digital experiences. Catchpoint's IPM platform analyzes telemetry from the world's largest, most diverse observability network, including thousands of locations in hundreds of countries, with cloud nodes at AppSource, backbone and broadband nodes, and the last mile where user experiences occur. With Catchpoint, you can find root causes faster, improve mean time to resolution, and cut down on finger pointing, because it's not always the network. Find out more at catchpoint.com/packetpushers. That's catchpoint.com/packetpushers. All right, back to the news. And just a trigger warning, I'm going to venture into some political territory here. So if you don't want to hear it, you should just skip ahead to the next item on a new IBM mainframe. Okay, so give you a second to skip. All right. So the Trump administration has revoked security clearances for all employees and executives of SentinelOne. This is a U.S. cybersecurity firm. Why? Because SentinelOne employs someone named Chris Krebs. So who is Chris Krebs? He's a well-known security practitioner. And prior to SentinelOne, he was head of the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, during the first Trump administration. And when Trump falsely insisted and continues to falsely insist that the 2020 election had been rigged, Krebs declared that the election was the most secure in history. This statement, which Krebs made while he was head of CISA, infuriated Trump. He's now targeting Krebs and his employer. Besides revoking security clearances, Trump has ordered the U.S. Attorney General and the Homeland Security Department to investigate Krebs's time as CISA's head. Ned, I wanted to bring up this issue because I think what's happening here is more than just like an investigation into somebody. I think by revoking security clearances, not just for Krebs, but for anyone at his employer, I think the Trump administration is sending a message to the cybersecurity community. And that message is toe the line. You know, security clearance being revoked is bad, but to me, that's not the real leverage. The real leverage is government contracts. And the message being sent is toe the line, our contracts could be next. I think the intent here is to having a chilling effect on the security industry. And by extension, frankly, any tech company that does business with the government, don't do or say anything the president happens to agree with, or you could face consequences. Your take here, am I just being like a paranoid lib or?
Oh, no. You are absolutely correct. And that is very directly the message from the Trump administration. They're not being coy about it. And it's not only cybersecurity agencies that they're going after with this mode of attack. The U.S. government is one of the biggest employers and contractors in the world. And those government contracts are worth boku bucks for certain types of companies. So that is a big hammer that they can hold over anyone and say, you know, shape up or ship out. That's what I meant to say. And they've taken a similar tack with a number of major law firms.
Right.
Basically saying you have to cancel your DEI programs and you have to get in line with what we want. And if you previously pursued legal action for your clients, you know, it's not like the law firms do this. It's the clients.
Right.
Say,
they work on behalf of clients. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. If you previously pursued something that was negative to the Trump administration or Trump himself, you might be blacklisted regardless, and you just won't get any new government contracts and will tell everyone not to work with you.
Yep.
It's a bit of a scorched earth policy, and some law firms have bent the knee and sworn fealty and said, we won't do any of these bad things anymore. And others are saying, well, no, we'll get by. I'm curious to see if there's a similar response from the cybersecurity community or if they'll rally behind Chris Krebs.
Well, the initial reaction is that the chilling effect is working. So Reuters reached out to 33 big U.S. cybersec companies and three industry groups for a comment about the administration's actions against SentinelOne. Only one organization commented on Trump's actions. That's one organization out of 36 contacted. So it seems like the threat so far is working. I will say that the one organization that did respond, it's a Washington-based industry group called the Cyber Threat Alliance. They sent this statement to Reuters, quote, targeting a company because the president does not like someone in the company is an example of the very weaponization of the federal government the memo claims to be combating, end quote. Yes, I think that's accurate.
I have to be curious if this action violates some sort of federal statute or standard, and if SentinelOne is going to pursue legal action against the Trump administration for what they did. I got to imagine with millions of dollars on the line, they probably will attempt to do that. Of course, now they have to find a law firm that is willing to take on the case.
That's the thing, is it's this 1-2 punch of, can you find someone to represent you if your rights have been violated? It's a little scary.
Indeed.
All right. Okay. Trigger warning over. We're getting back to some tech news. And Ned, we've finally reached that long promised story about a new IBM mainframe.
Indeed. The IBM Z17 is coming in June, and it is AI-orific. That's a real word. You can go look it up.
Is it really?
No.
Okay, good. Thank God.
I hope not. We already have agentic, and that makes me cringe a little bit inside. So last year at the Hot Chips conference in 2024, yes, it is called Hot Chips. No, I will not be taking any questions. IBM announced their forthcoming Z17 mainframe that was powered by the Telum II chip. Not only are mainframes still a real thing that people use, IBM is actually making new ones. And the Telum II processor in particular will have 43 billion transistors on the die with 8 cores and a built-in DPU and AI accelerator, all clocked at about 5.5 gigahertz, which, if you compare to the latest processors from, say, Intel, that's a pretty high clock speed.
So this is an IBM chip, the Telum II.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, IBM designed and, well, I don't think they fab it, but it's an IBM designed and owned chip. You can't get it anywhere but in the Z17.
Exclusive.
The Z17, like all mainframes, is built from drawers of CPUs and other components that all work as a single system. And the Z17 in particular can have 4 sockets in each in a drawer with 2 chips per socket and 4 drawers, which means you can have 32 of these chips in a single system with a total of 256 cores and 64 terabytes of memory.
Wow.
That does not include an additional 12 drawers that could be dedicated for things like storage, cryptographic processors, and AI accelerator cards, which are also going to be part of this, using their new Spire AI accelerator cards that have 32 cores per card, and you can have 48 cards assigned to a single system. It's a lot of computing power.
It's a ton of computing power, yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting is because of the way that mainframes are built, they have, or at least the Z-series ones, have special dedicated buses for inter-processor communication across all the drawers. So it's not, you know, hopping onto the PCI bus for one processor and one drawer to talk to another. They have their own dedicated bus to send that communication that I assume runs extremely fast.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, the dedicated AI accelerator cards are going to be using a PCI 5 bus in these mainframes, which is capable of 32 giga transfers per second, which is about 128 gigabytes per second of transfer bandwidth, like per 16 lanes, I think is what it works out to. So basically, this thing is a beast.
Yeah, and, huge beast.
It also has a very hefty price tag, I have to imagine, one that's going to become even heftier considering the current tariff climate.
But the kind of customers I presume they're going after with this probably are willing to pay it, you know, banks, large research institutions. Don't airlines rely on mainframes quite a bit?
Indeed. IBM's marketing says that 45 of the top 50 banks and 4 out of the 5 top airlines all still use mainframes as part of their core platform.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given the track record recently of airlines and banks, I don't know if that's the flex that IBM thinks it is. But still, a study commissioned by IBM claims that 70% of the world's production IT workloads are still handled by mainframes. I'm sure there's a bunch of caveats around that. It was commissioned by IBM.
Right.
But the point is, like, mainframes are still a thing that people are using. So if you have a few million dollars burning a hole in your pocket, you could have the Z17 come this June.
Nice. All right, links in the show notes. Moving on, Reuters is reporting that Apple has airlifted 600 tons of iPhones manufactured in India to the United States. This is in an effort to build up inventory that won't be affected by tariffs. Reuters says Apple had made a concerted effort over the past several months to ramp up iPhone production at a Foxconn plant in India. The news source estimates that Apple has managed to get about 1.5 million phones onto U.S. soil via the airlift. According to Reuters, the price of a top-end iPhone could rise from $1,600 to $2,300 based on current tariff rates. So you could see why they would want to get phones onshore before those tariff hikes hit.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is quite a significant hike.
Yes, it is.
And Apple's not going to absorb that cost. They're passing that right along.
I assume they would. And, you know, frankly, with the cachet of an iPhone, I don't know that people would blink too hard at a $2,300 price tag. I could be wrong, but we'll find out.
Yeah, I think it depends on the buyer. We are an Android family in our household. And right now that's looking pretty good.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure those phones are going to rise in price for similar reasons as well.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, we're split in my house. I'm Android. My wife is Android. The kids are more iPhone because they're cool.
House divided.
That's right. Yeah, texting is a nightmare. I have to say the airlift, it doesn't quite have the same stirring ring as like the Berlin airlift when Allied forces had to overcome a Soviet blockade and fly food and supplies into West Berlin. But this is the time we live in, I guess.
We need our iPhones.
Ned, you've got a story on Riverbed.
Yeah, Riverbed has released a new version of their observability tool, and it comes with plenty of, you want to take a guess?
Does it have two letters?
It does. It's AI. Mm-hmm. There's so much AI in this thing that the press release is just laden with AI every third sentence, if not more. But essentially, they're introducing three new features in their observability platform. One is called IQ Assist, which is meant to visualize technical issues in a graphical interface and also has the capability to sync issues with external logging and incident management tools.
Huh?
Then they have predictive AI, which will look for fluctuations and anomalies and alert admins when it sees something hinky, to use a technical term. And then it has agentic AI, which is meant to automate remediation with drag and drop tools and task specific agents. I think, and tell me what you think, Drew, the last one sounds the scariest out of those, this agentic AI thing that's auto remediating stuff for me. Like, whoa, I don't know how I feel about that.
I mean, the industry is definitely moving that way. You'll find a lot of, observability tools, a lot of network monitoring and management tools that have the capability for what they call automated remediation. But I think most folks approach that sort of with the 10-foot pole approach. Prove it to me first. Let's try a few test cases before I start letting you run wild. So yeah, I can understand why that makes people a little nervous.
Yeah, it reminds me of some of the tools that were promised back when vRealize operations was a thing. I guess it probably still is, but when I was still familiar with it, it was trying to do very similar things, like auto remediation of issues that were detected and anomaly detection by watching your vSphere clusters over a long period of time and developing a profile and doing all those kinds of things.
Yep.
I got to imagine that the machine learning has gotten better and the models have become more accurate over time. And this is not just trying to do it for a single vSphere cluster. This is trying to do it across a much larger environment. One thing that I didn't see in the blog posts was any mention of MCP or Model Context Protocol, which appears to be the new hotness. But I have to imagine that will be powering the agentic AI backend to provide tools to allow it to actually accomplish these proposed remediation actions.
So Model Context Protocol, my understanding is it is an open source project, I think launched by Anthropic. And it's essentially a protocol to let applications communicate with services, with data sources, with other applications, if you want to build out some kind of agentic AI that needs to touch multiple systems to complete a task.
Yeah, it defines a way for a MCP client to talk to an MCP server and for that MCP server to offer up, like I said, data sources, prompts, and tools to actually accomplish things. And it puts something more formalized in place that now anybody who wants to write a tool or a server for these MCP clients, they can do that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very interesting move, and it kind of puts a standard around what people were trying to do with agentic AI already. If you want to know more about it, I think there's a heavy networking episode coming up soon.
There is a heavy networking coming up. We're talking to John Capobianco from Selector AI about MCP, among other things. But Ned, you have also beaten us to the punch. You've got a day two DevOps show about it.
We haven't recorded it yet, but we have it on the books that we're having a guest that is also deep in the MCP verse coming on to talk about his experience and what he's building with it. And if you want to see John on yet another platform, John Capobianco, I had him on a live stream with Marino Wijay, was that 2 weeks ago?
Oh, cool.
Or maybe 3 weeks ago. And he was giving some demos and talking through what he's built. So we'll include a link to that in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. John is always worth your time. He's a passionate, interesting, I don't know if I want to say visionary because that sounds a little too hyperbolic, but he's pushing boundaries and loves doing it. And his enthusiasm for technology is infectious. So even if you disagree with him, he's still fun to watch. So go check it out. And yes, do keep an eye out for MCP. I think it is going to be something we'll be hearing more about. Again, as Ned mentioned, we don't know if Riverbed is using MCP under the covers to accomplish this, but expect to hear more about Model Context Protocol. Because AI is inevitable, and it is the only thing we'll be talking about soon. All right, to wrap up, network automation vendor Glueware has announced an integration with NetBox. NetBox is a popular repository and data modeling platform for network data. It's meant to serve as a source of truth for network state and configuration. That's a logical pairing, I think, for a network automation platform to integrate with a network repository. I didn't have a chance to dig into more details about what this integration actually means, and the details do matter, but I do think this is a sign that we're going to see more integrations between automation tools and repository tools teaming up, because it makes perfect sense for them to team up, assuming they get the integrations right. Any thoughts on that, Ned?
No, just to say I agree with you. I think that's a key point of potential integration, and curious to see what they brew up.
Yep. Link in the show notes if you want to find out more. That does wrap up the news portion of the show. Ned, thanks for stepping in for Jonna. Where can folks find you online, assuming that you want to be found?
I do want to be found. You can find me on the Packet Pushers Network. I am on Day 2 DevOps with my amazing co-host, Kyler Middleton.
Kyler is great.
Please check that out.
Yep.
And then also, if you just want to see what else I'm up to, go to my website, nedinthecloud.com. There you'll find all my videos and blog posts and other random thoughts. And connect with me on LinkedIn. My invites are available and open.
You've also, you do a lot of training, and you have training materials out there, right?
I do. I have many, many courses. I'm almost up to 50 on Pluralsight.
Damn.
So if you want to learn about HashiCorp Vault or Terraform, head on over to Pluralsight, and you'll find a ton of stuff there.
Awesome. And also, don't forget your Chaos Lover podcast, which is outside the Packet Pushers universe, which is fine. But yeah, it's there.
Yes, if you want to venture out, Chris Ainer and I every week have a tech news of the week where we cover four stories. And then we also do a deep dive on a technology once a week, usually from a historical lens.
Awesome. Thanks, Ned. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I'm on Blue Sky at Drew C. I'm blogging at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our episode sponsor, Catchpoint. And please do stick around as we talk with Nokia in our Tech Bytes episode about the SaaS version of its data center automation software, EDA. That's coming right up.
Today in the Tech Bytes podcast, we cover Nokia's event-driven automation, their EDA product, delivered as a service. Now, you might think it's SaaS instead of on-prem. What's the big deal? Well, to answer that question, we're joined by Sam Arora, Senior Product Line Manager at Nokia, today's episode sponsor. Sam, welcome to Tech Bytes. And for those folks in our audience who have not heard of EDA, would you give us a quick overview?
Yeah, sure. No problem. Thanks for having me on board. So EDA, in a nutshell, is just a event-driven automation. So EDA stands for event-driven automation. All it is a network automation tool to deploy your data center fabric network in a easy, fast method without any sort of headaches, process involved in that one. So it's a automation tool to deploy your network.
Very good. And if you're listening and you're a Packet Pusher subscriber, you will find another Tech Bytes that we cover EDA with an overview. And there's also a YouTube video at the Packet Pushers YouTube channel where you can watch for some EDA in action. Now, Sam, my gut reaction to the announcement of EDA as a SaaS service was kind of what I said in the intro. It's like, what's the big deal, man? But then as we had done the prep call, there is more here than just running EDA in the cloud. You explained a whole bunch of things to me. So maybe the way to go about it is walk me through the onboarding process of EDA as SaaS.
Right. So EDA as a SaaS is maybe better managed as a managed SaaS. So we host and manage the entire EDA core platform for our end customers. So what that means is the customer gets a URL to the EDA platform, and then they can access the platform right away from that URL. There's a few different options in there. Customers can pick either a shared model, a dedicated model, or a MSP model. So if they want to have some multi-tenancy in there, that is an option for customers.
Well, when you say shared or dedicated, as in I can deploy my EDA instance on dedicated hardware just for me, or I can have it be a more traditional shared model?
Correct, exactly. So you have your options there. So you have a shared model if you want to share some EDA core with a few other customers, if you have a small deployment, but if you want a dedicated deployment for yourself, you can do that. And then on top of that dedicated platform, you have the option of having an MSP. So you can have multi-tenancy built into the software. Yep.
So if I'm managing a bunch of fabrics for my customers, they don't need to know what's going on necessarily. No. I can just deploy that EDA as SaaS, run that for several of my customers.
Exactly. So they have no idea what's going on in the background, and you can make it run and off you go. Yep.
Got it. Okay. What else as I'm walking through this onboarding process happens?
So there is some licensing involved in this. So as every SaaS project has a licensing, so there is a platform license that the customers need to have. And then on addition on top of that, you have the add-on packages. So any additional switches you have in there, so platform license gives you 20 switches by default. If you have any more than 20 switches, you need to buy the additional packages on top of that. So depending if you have 50 switches, you'll have 20 included, extra 30 will make you the 50, and off you go. And then the only additional piece with the EDA SaaS option is the connections to the data center. So you can have multiple data centers globally if you wanted to in the world, and then you can connect it just via an IPsec tunnel, and then you're good to go.
Okay, so the IPsec tunnel, the point of this is I need to have my management traffic that is flowing between EDA and my physical infrastructure. They got to be connected somehow. And so the standard way to do that is standing up a tunnel.
Yeah, easiest way to do it is IPsec tunnel, the way they go.
Let's say I'm a large customer. I've got infrastructure scattered around the globe in various data centers. Is there a strategy for dealing with that?
Not necessarily a difficult one. It's just a multiple IP connections into the different data centers that you have. So every data center you have, whether it's in the same city as you know where you are, or if across the globe deployment, you create an IPsec tunnel. You can create it in a local entity so that you have low latency connections to the platform, and then you can access the platform and away you go. So you can have endless data centers if you needed to. Depends on your structure. So if you're a small company, you can easily just deploy it once and to one data center. Or if you have, you know, 10 global data centers, you can connect it to 10 different global centers. And that's it.
So is it one EDA as SaaS instance I'm running with different tunnels? Or is it, do I deploy like one to like a global POP somewhere or a regional POP, I guess?
So one to many, let's say. So the one EDA core to multiple data centers across the globe.
Got it. Okay. So I just got to pick a POP that is going to be perform well from a latency perspective.
Yeah, closest to you by location, right? So your ultimate goal in networking is always to have low latency. So you always want to pick the POP location closest to you to leverage that process.
Okay. So I got my plumbing done. My EDA instance is up and running. And is this greenfield, or can I like go through a discovery process if I've already got a fabric out there?
So you already have a fabric on there. You need to do some configurations on the platform and then activate the service, and then away you go. There's little to do there, but there is some configuration you need to add on there.
Configuration I would add in, you're saying like on my switches, you know, in the fabric, so yep, that EDA can EDA as SaaS can manage them.
Yeah, so on the EDA platform, you will then log in and you can create the node instances, and then you can use that to link your, let's say, virtual instance in the cloud to your physical instance in the data center.
Okay, so now I've got a link between the physical infrastructure and EDA as a platform. What is happening at that point? There is telemetry that is coming off the box and getting pulled into EDA, right?
There's lots of data being pulled off the box. So this is management plane only, right? So we only talk about management plane. There's no data plane going across this link at all. It's purely management plane. The process is, yeah, the node will send a lot of data to the EDA core platform. We inherit all that data, and then we can do different actions depending on that data. And then you can also do some configurations and push them down to the end device itself to create your data center fabric if one isn't created already. You can create it within the platform with a couple of clicks. I think it's 4 or 5 clicks, and away you go.
Any limitations to running EDA in the cloud versus on premises?
No, the structure is the exact same thing. So the only thought process here is where do you want your cloud to be, or your core platform to be, whether it's an on-premise in your own data center. That is an option that is available to customers. But if they want a cloud-hosted model, we offer that as well, and that's the EDA SaaS model. So customers don't need to worry about the let's say, overhead of managing a core platform, how to dedicate a team for a core platform, the monitoring that's in there. So we offer different sort of levels of service within our EDA platform.
Okay, and this gets to the core of why EDA as SaaS is more than just it's EDA on premises only, it's in the cloud. There's a bit more here, because as you described it, it's a managed service offering. That is, it's not just a platform upon which I'm running the software. It is that, but it is also, as you said, it's a managed service offering. There's more pieces to the puzzle here of what Nokia is giving me when I opt to deploy EDA in this way. So walk us through the differentiators.
Yeah, so the main part is we host and manage the entire core platform. So customers don't need to worry about that. So we do all the core platform monitoring to make sure that the pods are up. So this is EDA, going back to the initial point, EDA is built on Kubernetes. So it's an entire Kubernetes cluster that is deployed. We manage and host that cluster completely. So any issues in that pods, any issues on the cluster at all, we manage it and we can rectify it ourselves.
And more to the point, I don't have to care about Kubernetes. I don't need to be a Kubernetes admin to keep up with this install.
No. Not at all. Okay. Don't need to do any Kubernetes management, any Kubernetes monitoring or anything like that. So we manage all of that in-house today. And then on top of that, so we do the ETA management, and then we also do the node management at a level one stage. So if you think your typical process of doing support for your actual end nodes are in there.
You mean the switches that make up my fabric?
The switches, yeah, the data center fabric network. Yeah. Yep. So those switches themselves, those are the ones that we will manage from a layer one perspective. So any issues that happen, we are monitoring them, and we can escalate tickets on behalf of the customer up the chain of command to get resolved if there's any issues on there.
Okay. So you say layer one or level one perspective. What do you mean by that?
Right. So that just means sort of, you know, anytime you have data center fabric, you want it to be up, you know, 99.999% of the time. But there's always some sort of, you know, power issues or cable management issues or something goes on there. So we monitor that, and we are sort of in close communication with other end customers to make sure that if there's any sort of on-premise activity going on, maybe a power, you know, upgrade or downgrade or happening, cable management going on, we're aware of that. But if there's any sort of issues outside of this, any bugs that get raised or any issues on the node themselves that gets, you know, notified to us, we can take action on some of that stuff. We won't change the, you know, the node on behalf of the customer. We're just monitoring the node and make sure that it's up. If it's not up, we sort of can take actions and make sure that either we can rectify it or, you know, in close contact with the customer to figure out what's going on with that node.
Okay, so Nokia on my behalf is doing kind of what Onak would do. I mean, it's not, you're not going to do like, it's really the basic red light, green light kind of monitoring. And you're going to, well, you said there's some kind of mitigation that you might be able to do. You might be able to fix the what's
depends
broken.
Depends on
give,
the,
so give yeah. us an example.
Yeah, it depends on what the issue is, right? So if we know there's a memory leak or something going on with it, we may be able to, you know, schedule a reboot with the customer via the customer's sort of approval. They need to be the ones to do that process, but we can sort of figure that out, and we can work with the end customer to do it. So yes, you're right. We are sort of acting like a knock in a way, doing it level one support of that end device, which is the switch, to make sure that it's up and running. And if there's any issues, we can sort of address it or be in close communication with the customer to rectify it. So they don't need to have a dedicated knock team for the nodes.
And so are you guys watching my ETA instance? Is that how that's happening? Or are you rolling up the events that come out of my ETA into some, I don't know, super manager that you're collecting everything from all your customers that are using this?
Yeah. So we sort of do some sort of, let's say, we pull a lot of the data out of the ETA structure to manage it and take action if we ever need to. So no, we're not watching your day-to-day operations. We're not sort of watching you sort of build your data center in the fabric, utilize the fabric. We're not looking at the data that's going across there. All we care about is, are things up? Are things green? Yes, no. What do we do if they're red or down? Mm-hmm. What is the actions? That's on us to take care of.
Just so I know where the line is drawn, would you do anything like, oh, my nodes, my switches and my fabric need a NOS upgrade, and then do NOS upgrades for me if I asked, or no?
So it depends on the customer agreement plan that we have in place. So it is something that we could schedule with for the customer, but a lot of that stuff would be managed by them because they would have to communicate to their end users or end customers that need to sort of say, hey, this time frame, you know, we're going to have problems. So, you know, maybe expect to manage this. But in a typical data center fabric, there's always redundancy. So if you upgrade a node, just typically you're not going to notice it. In theory,
I'm just
right?
going to say, I'm not. Who's going to notice? Everything's redundant. Everything works perfectly. What could go wrong? It'll be
exactly,
great.
Exactly.
And actually, you know, we're being sarcastic because we're skeptical network engineers. but in theory, yeah, if you've built it that way and everything is up and running, you really should be able to take one switch down, one node down at a time and be okay. Not that you would just, you know, want to do it randomly, but yeah, that should be a thing that you can do.
Exactly. You can do it sort of in a scheduled maintenance window like you would normally in a traditional network. If you think of back to the traditional networking days of networking, you can easily do this, no problem. In theory, the customer should not know about it. But you know, let's say you do need to notify the customer just in case. You never want to be caught not telling the customer that you're going to reboot something.
Mm-hmm. What about upgrading the ETA software itself?
Right. So that is another service that we offer. So we install the software initially. So we do the initial installation of the servers, and then we do the upgrade platform. So however often there needs to be an upgrade, whether it's initial features or security patches or whatever needs to be done, that is hosted and managed by us completely. So we would do that in coordination with the end customer. Again, they won't notice it because there's redundancy built into this, and the downtime is very, very little, if any. So we host and manage it. So if there's a, you know, 6 months, every 12 months, there's an upgrade, we will do this pre-testing to make sure that that customer's use case has no issues in the release and the new features are in place. So we sort of let them know these are the new features that they can take use of. Maybe it benefits them, or you never know what's available in the new feature. And then also in the dedicated models that we have, if they want to skip an upgrade because they're like, oh, I don't need to worry about upgrading this, or I have a very important event that's happening and I want no issues whatsoever, that's sort of some policies in place, we can skip the upgrade. There's no harm in that by skipping an upgrade. Security patches wise, there's a bit of a question mark on what you want to do there, but for feature wise, if you're saying I don't need that feature, it's not an important feature to me, if you want to skip that one, you can do that. Or if you want to take a feature earlier than what we had initially planned, they can do that.
Okay. Any concerns with things like the bandwidth between cloud and my on-premises facility to handle whatever telemetry I might be pushing through? Any guidelines or concerns there?
No concerns there. So we, like I said, we inherit all the data from the nodes. Each node will send up data through the IPsec tunnel to our cloud environment to view in there. And then we can also push that back down to you if the end customer wants to receive it and they want to manage it and store it for a longer period of time. We can push it back down to the end customer and let that flow back down and make use of that data in some other way that they may want to use it for. But restrictions-wise, no, there's no restrictions. There's IPsec restrictions for sure, and how, you know, the speed of each IPsec tunnel, how many nodes can be supported by each IPsec tunnel, that's sort of set. But aside from the basics of IPsec tunnels, no, there's no sort of restrictions on latency or bandwidth concerns that you need to worry about.
Just common sense capacity planning. You got to understand the load that is going to be placed on that link by the telemetry that's moving through it and size appropriately. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So we have the data points of sort of how much each node would send in the data form, how many nodes you have in a data center. Well, how many IPsec tunnels would you in theory need then, right? Do you need maybe one or two? Do you need three or four, right? Ideally, you'll probably have an even number for redundancies anyway, but you need to have some policies in place for that for sure.
Okay. One natural question that people are going to have as they listen to this is multi-vendor support. Now, last time I had talked to Nokia about EDA, it's a Nokia support, is the supported vendor primarily, but that multi-vendor support was maybe coming in the future. Does that sound about right, Sam?
Yep, that's still the case. So we're still working, right now we're still working on the Nokia software itself, but we're adding a few others down the line as well. So in a couple of months, there should be some release notes to put out there for new multi-vendors that are being added to it.
Excellent. Okay, so let's say I want to take EDA as SaaS for a test drive or see a demo. Where's the right place to go?
So the same links that we've sort of used before in the past, just nokia.com, search for EDA Adventures and Automation, find the links in there and take a look at it. So a demo or a test drive is easily doable because we sort of host and manage it in a cloud environment. The turnip is fast, so we sort of create an account, see an email, a new link, and username, passwords, away you go. Testing it to take it for a spin, poke around in it, see what there is to offer for you.
Excellent. And Sam, what about you? Are you out there on the internet? You on LinkedIn? People can ask you questions and slide into DMs maybe?
For sure. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me there, ask me questions. We have a whole team here as well that I can relay some questions to if we need some assistance. But we're happy to answer any questions that people may have.
Well, Sam Arora, thank you for joining us, and thanks to Nokia for being a sponsor. Sponsors ensure that the Packet Pushers can continue to offer you high-quality, deeply technical content for your professional development for free. That includes a dozen podcasts on networking, cloud, security, IT strategy, and more, two newsletters, a YouTube channel, a Slack community, and again, more stuff. Find it all at packetpushers.net. And as we say, too much networking would never be enough.